Okay, here we go for those who are here. All the questions. There was a question last night in Thai. It was just a bit too hard. I still got the wrong one. Oh, never mind. I know what the question was anyway. The question was, I remember I was mentioning Mara and this person or this being who is always trying to stop people getting out of his control. And the question was, how come such a being has got so much power anyway? And it's just because of their good karma from the past. They made lots of good karma and been pretty good people. And to become a Mara. But even if you've done lots and lots and lots of good karma, you may rise very high. But if you haven't overcome the defilements, the ego and all that stuff which is in the mind, it's still very dangerous for you. So sometimes you may get yourself into positions of authority and power. And if you haven't got your act together, the office destroys you. So be very careful. As you rise through the ranks of power in the tax office, or if you rise through the ranks of power in Singapore Airlines, or if you rise through the ranks of power in the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, be careful. Because if you haven't got your act together, then all that power corrupts you. And this was a guy who rose and rose and rose, you know, and became the president of the Parinimitta Wasawati realm, the CEO of the realm, which it's true, the CEO of the realm which wields power over others. And so just that position gave his ego bigger and bigger and bigger until he lost it. This is what we say in the West. You lost it. You had your act together first of all, but then it just got to your head. And that's what happens to Mara. And because he got into that position of great power, and then he lost it. And it's always the case they do some really stupid things. And there's one case where it's actually the Buddha's chief disciple, Mahamoggallana. They had two chief disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana. And Moggallana was telling him he could recall a very, very long ago past life when he was a Mara. He got to that position, and because he was just really, really into the power trip, that he lost that position and went straight down to a hell realm. And it's very fascinating. This is what they say about even like monks. Because we're in a position of elevated responsibility and power, if we make a mistake and do something wrong, then, you may do it, and it's a certain amount of bad karma. If we do it, 5, 6, 10 times that amount of bad karma. And the commentary said it's like, if you're riding like a horse and you fall off, it's not that far down. But if you're riding an elephant, it's a long way down. It's like monks, you're looked upon as being high. And so if you fall off, you fall off a long way. That's the problem. If you're in positions of power and authority and respect, you've got to be very careful. If you did make a mistake, you fall down a lot further. That's what happens with Mara. And you can understand the reason why that happens. You've got to be very careful if you take positions of authority and power to make sure you can really do that, and that you have your checks and balances. These are my checks and balances. My monks, if I get over the top, they soon tell me. So that's really good to have checks and balances. Biggest danger is like a monk on their own or something, and they've got no one to talk to, and they're sort of so egotistical that they sort of no one can actually talk to them. So it's great having sort of monks around. Tell me off all the time. Well, not all the time, but sometimes. Okay, is that quite clear about the Mara question? Where Mara comes from, why he had so much power, and why he sort of dropped away again? And obviously at the beginning he would have been very respectful to like a Buddha, but after a while, that people are respectful, but afterwards they respect themselves after a while more than anybody else. And this is a problem. Dear Ajahn, I seem to be enjoying myself. Excellent, I think I'll stop there. No, I can't do that. I seem to be enjoying myself walking around the monastery ground and looking at the greenery rather than looking at my breath. I should have stopped. It doesn't matter. Look at the greenery and just see the beautiful greenery, but then stop for one piece of greenery and just one leaf or one blade of grass and stop there and allow the mind to focus in and become one with the blade of grass. And then allow your whole being to be mown away until you disappear into the mowing machine of emptiness. And see what happens. So it's okay to enjoy sort of this monastery, because looking at the greenery, it's much better looking at the greenery than looking at the television. In other words, that the greenery, the nature, is something which is conducive to peace, to quietness, to silence, to freedom. Which is why that, you know, the monks, you can live in a forest and you can get off on nature. When I first read these poems of these enlightened monks and nuns from the time of the Buddha, and you can read them as well, the Theragata or Therigata, they're really interesting. They really do need a new translation to really get them up to date. But even so, the old translations are still fascinating to see 25 centuries ago what it was like to be an enlightened person. And they started writing all these poems about how wonderful it was to live in nature, just with the greens, trees and the mountains and the caves, and then the wild birds and animals. And it got me sort of thinking that these people, that they were arahats, enlightened, they could still enjoy the nature. And because there are some things, if you find enjoyment in, you get attached to, but nature is, you know that the nature belongs to itself, that you can't control nature. And because nature is completely out of control, it's wild. Therefore, if you look at it, you can't attach to it, you can't control it, you can just enjoy it and leave it alone. So looking at nature and getting joy out of nature is not dangerous. So you can enjoy the nature around here. So if you're getting a bit dull, you know, and you just don't really feel like meditating, don't feel like walking, or don't feel like going, you know, to sleep or whatever, just go out and have a walk and enjoy that nature. It's okay. And then once you've enjoyed the nature, after a while you feel nice and peaceful and soft, because nature's a great teacher. And then you can just go and sit down, and the mind is happy. It's had a bit of fun, and now it can be peaceful. So in meditation retreats, we call this playtime, or recess. Because when you were at school, as a little kid, do you remember that you go to school in the morning, and you wouldn't study until 3 or 4 in the afternoon? Not only would you have lunch, you will have playtime, or recess. Then you go around, if you're a boy, you kick a ball around. If you're a girl, I don't know what you do, because we weren't allowed in the girls' playground, but whatever you do, you have playtime, you mess around, have fun. And even in a meditation retreat, for some of you, if you just meditate, walk and sit, walk and sit, walk and sit and walk and sit all the time, you get just so dull. Unless your meditation really takes off, and then you just want to do that. So, if it's getting dull, give yourself playtime. Okay, recess time now. You go around, don't bring a football in and start kicking it around. What I mean is go out there and enjoy nature. I should have said this, otherwise you see a football game, a soccer game, out in the park over there. And so Singapore versus Australia, I don't know. But anyhow, this is not what we do. What we do is actually just enjoy the quietness and the peace of nature. So it's okay doing that. But you know, after a while it just makes you peaceful, so that's fine. And after a while you want to watch the breath, so don't force the enjoyment. Don't think I should be enjoying the breath. Just, you can't sort of play games with the mind. You have to be honest. And if you feel like you just want to have a walk outside and sit and just watch the trees grow, that's fine. It's one of my favourite pastimes, just sitting and watching the trees grow. You have to be very patient and mindful to watch a tree grow. It does, you know. You know it grows, but can you watch it grow? It does. But every time you think a thought, it grows and you don't notice it. So you have to be very silent and patient. And if you're really quiet and patient, you may even see the trees grow. So if ever I'm sitting out there, people say, what are you doing? I say, I'm watching the trees grow. Ajahn! Aha! Here we go, the fault-finding mind. Can you please ask people not to talk or to receive calls from mobile phone? Thank you. I could do that, but I've already said that. So, remember what Ajahn Chah said. It's not the noise that disturbs you. It's you disturb the noise. Because that's what mobile phones do, they just go off every now and again. It's what people do. If they've got mouths, they will talk. I try to control you and say don't, but you will. So when someone talks, you don't talk back. In your head, silent. You know, they're talking, you're not allowed to talk. It's not fair. I'm going to tell Ajahn, well, I'm going to sort of write their name on this next time. I'm going to point to them. It was them, it was them, it was them, it was them. I'm going to really get them into trouble. I'm going to put a big notice by where they sit. You know, a big card that says, this person talks. Or even better, where they're sitting meditation nice and still, put a little sticker on their back. This person's got a mobile phone. So don't be the big thing about it, just leave it alone. No, try not to. There's one person I've given permission to, so that they can, because they've got a relation who's by themselves, a very old mother. I said, okay, that's all right to do that. They've asked permission to give them a call, because out of compassion. And sometimes it's very hard for us actually to stop, you know, with some of our duties. So if it's really, really necessary, you can come and ask me, and I'll say yes, sure. If it's that important you want to ask me, I'll always say yes. So, but as for you, just leave it alone. The mobile phone doesn't go off very long. But if they're talking all night, from sort of 9 o'clock afterwards, and on their mobile phone, you can hear them talking until 3 o'clock in the morning, then you can come and complain. If it's just one little one, just leave it alone. And whoever does, you know, use that mobile phone, very, very quiet. And please turn it off so it doesn't ring. So you can only, you ring out, but they can't ring in. They can SMS you in or something, because that doesn't make any noise. So try and leave the world, and then you'll be okay. On one retreat which I was giving in Sydney many years ago, there's one of these notes in here was also a complaint, because somebody was making a big noise all the time in the meditation hall. They were always breathing through their mouth. That's okay for just a few minutes, but that was going on all day. And so someone said, can you please tell people to breathe quietly? And actually what was happening, I had to tell people, that's a person who was dying of sinus cancer. And they were just giving the last shot to do a bit of meditation before they passed away. And they, you know, they didn't really know whether they could make it to the retreat. But they did. The whole nasal passages was blocked with the cancer. And when I told them about that, the person who wrote that sort of note felt very, very guilty. So I told them, don't feel guilty. But I'll actually learn from this. That sometimes we complain about these noises, and we don't know why the person did that. If we only knew why, we'd have more compassion. Think, oh yeah, they needed to do that. It's interesting, that person who had that sinus cancer was breathing very loud. You know, when I interviewed, I thought they were going to die. But I saw them sometime later in Sydney, and they were full recovery. It was actually on that retreat, that was the one where he told me, just the last day, he was meditating there, just and then he got quite peaceful, and he heard a pop. This is how he described it, pop, and he could breathe through his nose again. It was an amazing experience, just what happens in meditation. It only lasted about 10 or 15 minutes, and then it closed up again, he couldn't breathe. He had to breathe through his mouth again. But it was amazing that, you know, that was something physical. You know, he couldn't breathe all 8-9 days, and then suddenly he could again. Something popped and went open, just because of the peace of his meditation. Then it closed again, I thought, and it was a bit too late. But apparently he carried on meditating and he got through. And it was okay. Still alive. So, but the point was that when people realised why he was making that noise, they said, ah, never mind. Okay. Dear Ajahn, why is it that all these negative thoughts and emotions come up while meditating? Is it because we try to suppress them in our daily life? Because you're trying to suppress them now? Allow them to come up. Negative thoughts. The door of my heart's open to you. Come on. And some people have been doing that. They told me in their interviews. And when you do that, the thoughts stop. Because the negative thoughts come up, you're feeding them negativity. The negativity is coming from somewhere. It's got its source. And so those negative sources, I don't want this, I want to be peaceful, I don't want to meditate, I want to go to bed, I don't want to go to bed, I want to get up, I don't want this food, I want that food, I don't want to sit here, I want to sit over there. It's all that negative, complaining, fault-finding mind. And then you actually notice this, as you get that negative fault-finding mind more and more, it builds and builds and builds. And you get all these other negative thoughts. You look upon the world with fault-finding. There's always faults to be found in everything. Even in the Buddha, in the most perfect heaven, there's always some fault to be found, if you look hard enough. But in the most destitute, difficult, grey, dull, miserable place, there's always some fun to be found as well, if you know how to develop the mind which can appreciate joy and beauty in the mundane. And of those two, it's best to see the joy. So if you've got negative thoughts, see the beauty in the negative thoughts. Isn't this wonderful? A nice negative thought has come in to make the life interesting. Because it's not really boring just watching the breath all the time. Now I've got negative thoughts to have a look at. Whatever it is, just allow it just to pass through you. Don't hold it. Don't try and stop it. Make peace with it. It's nothing to do with you. It's not my business. Just like a negative black cloud has come through, it'll pass away again. This too will pass. So when it's coming up, it means just you're just maybe just washing through some old stuff. Let it come through. Make peace with it. Don't be negative to the negativity. And then the negativity disappears. Is that alright? Does that make sense? Okay, is anyone going to complain about my answer? Fault finding? It's really great when I stop fault finding, right? Then you can't complain anymore. It's really good. Dear Ajahn Brahm, in trying to remember the recognition, familiarity and comfort of different meditative states, I came up with the rugby football code. Oh yes, I did the AFL. Remember, the AFL is acknowledge, forgive and learn, and this is rugby football, RFC, to complement the AFL code for behaviour. However, maybe this is rather a coarse name for the refined states, even though it may be helped to recall these stages. Yeah, it's great, RFC, sorry. Is that what they call it, rugby football code in Australia? I don't know, but it sounds good anyway. RFC. So, recognition, familiarity, and comfort. The RFC code. That's the each state of meditation. Remember, you recognize what these states are. Things like present moment awareness and silence and the breath and the beautiful breath. Someone was telling me that they weren't doing anything, just the breath came. And when they didn't actually look for the breath, it just came by themselves. It was completely different. That's the real breath, not the imaginary, what you add onto the breath. The breath just comes up and there it is, nice and peaceful and still. It is so easy to watch when it comes up, when it wants to. So you recognize that and you become so familiar with it, you're just so comfortable there. You can just sit there having a wonderful time in comfort, and from the comfort you can go into the next stage. Aha, here we go. In the Anguttara Nikaya, that's one of the sutras, there Ananda is depicted saying that craving can be overcome by craving and conceit can be overcome by conceit. Can you please explain this statement? What he actually says there is that sometimes that you hear that someone in this retreat has just got a jhana. And this is their very first retreat, and they're sitting next to you, and they've been sleeping all morning. They just come here for one meditation and they hit the jackpot, and you think, oh, this is really unfair. But when you hear that someone else has done that, you think, wow, they can do it, so can I. So you do have a little bit of craving. But if that craving is not allied with wisdom, then you get lost. You say, I want to do this. But then remember, always look for what causes these jhanas. You've heard it many times, okay, I've got to let go. So the craving is just like a little bit of incentive. Once you have the incentive there, what am I supposed to do to be able to get into these states? And then you have to let go. So it's a craving to let go of craving. It's not really a craving. Because if you're trying to let go of craving, you're trying to let go of craving, you're trying to let go of craving, it doesn't work. You're craving to make the causes. That's what the craving means. And the conceit, to overcome conceit, is, well, they can do it, why not me? I've got, you know, two legs, just like anybody else. You know, I can cross them, I've got a brain like anybody else. What's the difference? They could do it in the time of the Buddha, why can't I? And if you think like that, the conceit can actually say, well, I can do it. And that will actually give you the confidence. That's what he was really meaning. It was a strange saying, because Ananda said this, not the Buddha. But it was actually what he was saying, that you can sort of start off with a bit of craving, but you have to stop it pretty quickly if you want to get really deep into the path. You can have a bit of conceit to begin with, but that just gets you started. You have to overcome it pretty quickly. That's what it really means. Anyone got any questions about that? Going. Here we go, next one. At every retreat, there are always more women. Why? What are the causes to be reborn as a woman? Yeah, because if you men make a lot of good karma and you get reborn as a woman, then you can come to more retreats. Does that make sense? Well, it seems that women tend to do more retreats, and that's really good, you know, and that's the path to enlightenment. So it's obvious that, you know, that women have an easier time. There's more women get enlightened. Isn't that the case? You don't think so? Some of you keep shaking their head. Why are more women come to retreats? I think, was it because all the men are already enlightened? Is that the reason? Or the men only need to come once and they get into jhanas, women have to come again and again and again. Is that the answer? No, it's a very interesting one. I think, I'm not quite sure why that is. Why there are always more women, but this retreat, there is much more women than men in most of the retreats which I give. It's usually pretty getting close to an even number, but this retreat is many more women. I think this is the biggest percentage of women in maybe any retreat which I've done than before. Usually there's always more women, but this one is really many more women than men. So whatever the reason, I don't know, maybe we should do more marketing, maybe we should make this a more male friendly retreat, maybe we should have sort of the rugby sort of playtime here. I don't know, but who cares anyway, because when it gets down to the real truth, there is no man or woman, that's just a body you happen to be inhabiting in this lifetime. The mind has got no gender. That's why your mind, your stream of consciousness, can go from this body into a female body, into a male body, into an animal, into a deva, because the mind has got no gender. It can go into any type of body. And if you get into the jhanas, you'll experience that mind which has got no gender. And all these gender differences, they finish at the Brahma realm. In the Brahma realm, which is the jhana realm, there's no more gender. So there's no more male or female. The male or female go up to just above Mara's realm, because you call Mara a him, or it could be a her, but above that there's no more gender. All this gender business stops when you go to the realm of the mind. So that all there is in this retreat here is just, was it 50 minds, 50 jitters, just happen to be in a woman's body or a male body, an Australian body or an Asian body or whatever other body you have, who cares? The point is that that is not you. Even your mind is not you, but it's much closer. So, there are no men in this retreat. There are no women in this retreat. There is just sort of minds. Does that wash, or is I'm just trying to do a spin? Okay. Anyway, it's a tough question, so I'll leave that one. Suggestion. Aha. May I suggest for the future retreat centre up in Serpentine to have showers and toilets to be kept in a completely separate building and some walking distance away from the living quarters, because the sound of running taps, showers, or the sound of someone sitting on the toilet doing their stuff, and not to mention the extra set of doors opening and closing leading to the ensuite, and oh yes, the sound of two extra switches for the light and exhaust flicking on and off, would reverberate through to the other rooms if it is the proposed current arrangement. It's just a thought that popped into my mind whilst meditating. I don't know what type of meditation you're doing. In my room, and someone slammed the toilet seat down and shook me right out of my peaceful abiding. It's amazing what questions you get here. Nah, okay. Nah, it is true that sometimes these things make a lot of noise. And the plumbing in this place is a bit noisy, but this is an old place. And when we do our Buddhist retreat center, the plumbing will be silent. And we'll teach you to be mindful just when you plop your stuff in the bowl. That way it'll be soft. I don't know what you're going to do. Now, and also the next week we'd have no laughter because that disturbs everybody. There's more noise with laughter. So you can't expect people to be absolutely quiet because this body is noisy. That's what it does. So you can't really do much about it, especially this vegetarian food. They have all these beans and stuff. What do you expect? But I take your point, and where actually the meditation room is will be a distance, not that far distance, but separated from the living quarters, and the toilets and showers next to the meditation room are separate, so you shouldn't be able to hear anything there. And in your little rooms there, it's only like the plans. I think we still can keep those plans that there's going to be like pods, like little cottages, and each cottage has 6 rooms, another one which is further away. So there'll only be sort of en suites there, 6 showers and 6 toilets in each pod. So you have your own shower and toilet. And this is especially for like sick people or elderly people. I really want to make this, because of my experience of seeing people like that fellow in Sydney, you can basically got rid of his cancer through this meditation. And if they're very, very old and sick and they're just about to die, let them do a bit of meditation. It's really important. And each one of you is going to get sicker and older, so you know this is your investment for the future. It's a waste of time. This is what we kept on saying. This was, where was it? This was in, I forget now. We had this great idea of let the young people have all the ideas, and the middle-aged people, they're the ones who've got the funds, they can make the donations. That's the way it really works. And so if middle-aged people are going to make the donations, they want to have a comfortable retreat center. Otherwise they're not going to be able to use it. So that was my idea, I just make it comfortable. But you can, there's no reason why you can't have quiet plumbing. And it's just that this place is an old place and it was done very cheaply, and so the plumbing is not the best. And it wasn't built as a meditation retreat centre. This is the quietest this place ever is when we have our Buddhists here. The rest of the time it's always very noisy, talking, goodness knows what else. But when you build a retreat centre, especially for meditation, especially for quietness, then you just put a little bit more effort into making quiet plumbing. And nice thick walls, so you shouldn't be able to hear the person next to you at all. And that way that everyone can get a nice night's sleep. And also you can sleep at any time without being sort of woken up by the flush. Well look, you know, this in my monastery, the first couple of years, in the hot season here, it was in the 40s. And the only quiet place I could find, the only room which was quiet, was in the shower down at the monastery. So I went in there, it was cool. You know, because they had tile floors, and I sat there in the sort of shower cubicle thinking I'd get a nice meditation there. And I know what it was like, because then somebody went to the toilet, and as soon as they went in the toilet, plop plop plop, flush flush flush, that was the end of my meditation too. So you know, you can't. But in our retreat centre we should be quiet plumbing, so there should be no problem there at all. Next question. Dear Ajahn, could you please tell us a little bit about dependent origination and will? Only a little bit. This is a huge thing, but what dependent origination really means is like how things arise, how they originate from a cause. And this is a wonderful thing. The whole detail is very complicated. You see, everything which comes up, there's a cause which brings it into being. Everything. Including your will, including your mind, including the thoughts. Everything has these causes. And once you work out how it all works, what the causes are, then you can get some sort of way of not really controlling, but being able to allow these things, these states to arise. Well, you know how will arises, and actually you can take away those causes, and so there's no will, there's no doing, there's no choice anymore. So it's one. It's great actually. Whenever you have a will and intention, you ask, where did that come from? Why did I want to do that? So even when you sort of want to sort of move and change the position of your legs, why? Where did that come from? And why? And how did it work? And it's great when you sort of go back to, why did I decide to talk like this? Why did I decide to become a monk? And you see what we call conditioning. Even what you think is your will is basically totally conditioned. You see that, you know, sometimes if you're a dominant character in a monastery, you know, like I'm the abbot, you see that, you know, I imagine this happens. I don't see this. If you see how, like, someone like Ajahn Chah giving a talk, sometimes you'll start talking like me. You'll have some of the phrases, or some of the other monks as well will start, because you just imitate. That's just the nature. And say, did you choose to do that? Not true choice at all, it's just complete conditioning. You are almost like, not brainwashed, but your will is influenced by all of your conditioned experiences. So you find out where your will comes from. It's not yours. Even the choice, you see where it comes from. You can trace it back, why you chose to do that. And when you can see that, then you understand this will which is coming up is nothing to do with me. It's just a process. It comes from causes. When those causes disappear, so does the effect. And a lot of will is coming again from discontent, from wanting. A lot of it comes from delusion of thinking, when I get this, then I'll be happy. So you will and you strive and you get that will so strong, you're really going to get it this time. And it's just enhancing that will. And you just get, as I say, frustrated. That's, you can see where the cause of will comes from, you can see where it goes to. It always ends in disappointment and frustration when you never get what you really want. So how many people here are completely satisfied? How many people still trying to get something out of life? And you're just trying to hone or sharpen your will to try and make it sort of more effective. So next time when you want something, you know what you're wanting, and next time you'll get it. And that's just a waste of time. You'll never be able to achieve anything that way. Even like someone like Mara, in the position of absolute power, can get whatever he wants, still is not satisfied. This is one of the problems with will. Always leads to frustration, to dissatisfaction, and often to anger and violence. So, but once we see where it goes to, we see where it comes from, then we can see the origination of all of these things. You see its origination, you can see how the whole process works. It's nothing to do with me. And not only dependent origination, the most important part is seeing dependent cessation. Not how it originates, but how everything stops. And that's the most interesting part. To see how things disappear. To see when a cause disappears, then so does the effect. And the main cause for dependent cessation is wisdom, waking up, seeing what's happening, and that's the cause for the whole process of samsara to unravel. You only suffer because of stupidity, because of ignorance, because of delusion. This life is like the movie, and you take the movie to be real. And so when the boy and the girl, they can't marry, you cry, oh, it's so sad. Or when somebody gets shot or something, oh, it's so sad. Or when they manage to get together again, oh, it's so sweet. Whatever it is, the movies which people get sucked into, I used to see that when I used to go to movies. I used to have what's called the tear jerkers. And you knew what was going to happen. You knew you were going to cry your eyes out, but still you went. What did you do that for? Masochist, that's all you are. Just allow your emotions, or these horror movies, where you're going to be absolutely terrified. And why do you do that for? Why do you join the movie called life and think it's something real is happening out there? So it's only delusion causes the problem. And you see things. It's not me, not mine. It's like that simile I gave of when I used to go to the movies, people were allowed to smoke in the movie theatres. And so that every now and again, even as a kid, you'd see me watching the movie. And then I just looked back a bit and I saw this cone of light going from the screen, getting narrower and narrower and narrower. And you can look back and there it was coming from a little room, this little guy in the back. And it wasn't reality on the screen. All it was this guy with a machine and just light going through this celluloid. Once I saw that, what it really was, it wasn't a monster there. It was just like a light trick. And then, you didn't get upset or you didn't get excited. You didn't get sad. It was just a movie, that's all. But why do people want to get involved in the movie? Because of stupidity. They want to be excited. They want to feel the emotions. They want to feel afraid. This is why I can't imagine why people do this bungee jumping or they go on these new death rides or death drops. And just even just the other day at that Buddhist Light International Buddha's birthday celebration, which I went to last week. They had these like rides there. I don't know what they were doing in the Buddhist ceremony. But they were going really fast. And when I actually saw them going round and round and round, it made you sick going in there. Especially if all these stalls selling food first of all, then you're going one of these things. Perhaps that's what they do it, to throw up so they're empty, they can go round again and eat more food, I don't know. But why do people do that? Scare the life out of themselves. Because they just want to be excited. And this is the trouble here, that's the delusion. We think that that's going to be happiness. But real wisdom is just understanding that peace and stillness is where happiness lies. Question is, no, basically you're out of control. No, you might as well let go. Let's just give up. You do much better karma if you just shut up and give up and sit down. What's the best karma you can possibly do? Get enlightened. You're stuffed now. Stuffed up your will. No end in this retreat. Yeah, it's good karma. It's even better karma. You're unconditioning. You're deconditioning. No, just be careful of that. Because that is more control. And you just make a mess that way. So you think you're doing very good. All the do-gooders are the ones who cause all the problems. We really think we're doing something good for the world. And it's the simile which I gave. It's like a person being born in prison, raised in prison. And that's all they know is prison. And they spend all their life just going helping other people in prison. Instead of telling people, look, mate, you're in prison. And you can walk out. There's a big hole there dug by the Buddha. It's called the Eightfold Path Hole. Just walk out, go out. So no, I've got to help everybody else. Look, the hole is there. That's the best way you can help other people. You walk through, maybe some other people might follow you. But too many of us spend all our life just decorating the prison cells, trying to make something, bearable about what is basically unbearable. So the message is, get out. Be quiet, be still. The best calm you can possibly make is becoming enlightened. So no more will. That is unconditioning the whole mind. Deconditioning that which keeps you sort of attached to samsara, which keeps you doing things and keeping the self going. Remember that even if you think you're doing good things, you're creating a self there, an ego, a me, a mind who does the good things. Even good karma creates rebirth in good realms, but still rebirth. And you've been up and down from the beautiful heaven realms to the lower realms and in between, the human realms, so many times. Making good karma is fine, you get to heaven realms, but it just goes round and round. You don't get out. So after a while, you stop all that conditioning. You stop and be still. And then you see, you know, just the illusion of life, thinking we are in control. You try and help other people, but it's impossible. People just do what they want to do. They go according to their conditioning. The only thing you can do is to teach people to stop. And only then can they get out of samsara. The best karma you can possibly do is to get into deep meditation. See the truth. Become enlightened. Take a few other people with you. Bye-bye. So that's stopping the mind. So that's what you should really be up to. And that's unconditioning everything. Okay, next question. That's a deep one. We'll get into enlightenment later on during this retreat. This is a bit early. We haven't even got jhanas yet. Read in Ajahn Chah's book, he was quoted as saying, giving to make merits is bad karma. Is this true? Ajahn Chah would keep on saying so many different things to different people. And you can never really tie him down. And recently when I was at this meeting of all the senior abbots of Ajahn Chah's tradition from the Western world last January, we were just talking about this one monk. Paul Brighter is now, he used to be a monk before, and now he's written a couple of books, and he was saying that, and I remember this, he, when he was about 4 or 5 years, you know, if you're really a good monk, you could ask Ajahn Chah to go like on walkabout, on Tudong they called it, you can wander from place to place. So he's trying to build up courage to ask Ajahn Chah, you know, can I go just on walkabout by myself? And so he was at Ajahn Chah's hut one night, and these two very, you know, reasonably middle senior monks, very good monks, they went up there to ask permission to go on this Tudong, you know, to stay in the caves, in the forest, by oneself, to practice, to visit, you know, great teachers, leave your home monastery and just get a bit more experience. And Ajahn Chah had done that himself for many years, and these were two very good monks. And so Ajahn Chah said, oh, of course, it's a wonderful thing you're doing, you can find nice peaceful places, live in the forest, you know, face the tigers, you know, just go to find some solitude in some wonderful caves. And he was reminiscing of all his wonderful experiences when he went by himself away from the monastery with no support, staying in this mosquito net and these beautiful places. He was praising this Tudong. So Paul Brighter thought, wow, this is my chance. So the next morning he went up to Ajahn Chah and said, Venerable Sir, can I go on Tudong? And Ajahn Chah said, it's a waste of time going on Tudong. It's just lazy monks go on there. You don't get anything at all. You're just indulging. And he said the complete opposite. And the point was that Ajahn Chah would only speak to the person, not to the thing. So when Ajahn Chah said this, you've got to ask who he was talking to. Because it's not like a question, not an answer, which applied in all circumstances, like some pope speaking sort of ex cathedra. It was related to the situation, to the time. And at the end of his life, I remember him telling me, he said, look, sometimes I see someone like on a bicycle and they're leaning to the left. I say, lean to the right. And other times I see him leaning to the right. I say, lean to the left. And people think that I'm contradicting myself, because someone I say, yeah, go on Tudong, or don't go on Tudong. The reason why I said that first people to go on Tudong, because, you know, they were leaning in the correct direction. So I said, yeah, go that direction, that's good. But this poor Brighter, you know, he was leaning completely the wrong direction. So no, no, don't do that. So you have to answer the person first of all. So giving to make merits is bad karma. That was probably talking to somebody who was just really in to sort of seeing how great I am. I give the best food to Ajahn Chah, and look how great I am. I gave the big donation. And sometimes you have that in some monasteries. You have the whole list there of like who gave what and how much. And that's the sort of stuff which Ajahn Chah was saying. No, no, that's just more ego, more pride. That's not really making merits. If you go up here, you know, and at the end say, oh, I'm going to give a big check to the meditation retreat center. And you come up here with this big check. You see everybody, how much I'm giving to the retreat center. See. Can I put it in the newsletter? And of course, that's bad karma. Because that just is encouraging your pride. And some people have done that, you know. They've actually, on these donation envelopes, they've written this big amount. And I got really excited and I opened it up and it's not in there. I don't know if they've forgotten, but you know, sometimes I wonder what's going on. Test me. I don't know, but I think that's maybe that's what he means. Giving to make merits, or giving to test the Ajahn, his bad karma. But that's what it's really mean. It's like why you're giving. But if you really know how to give, then that's always good karma. And when you give, it's giving expecting nothing back in return. That's what we mean by good karma. And the best act of giving is giving your bottom to your meditation cushion, expecting nothing back in return. I donate my bottom to the cushion. And you just sit there. If you want jhana back, or if you want sort of to sit for many hours, that's giving, expecting something back. That's why it never works. So next time you meditate, so I do my act of dharma, I give my bottom to the cushion. You can take it, so you forget about it then. So give your mind to the breath, or to the present moment, but don't expect anything back in return. If you expect something back, it is not giving, it's doing business. But it says here, if I were to say to myself in my meditation, be patient, isn't that doing? Or be quiet? To be would be the words of a controller, right? Thank you. Yeah, so don't even say anything. So don't say anything, me. Shut up. So it's not doing nothing, it's nothing doing. There's a lot of difference between doing nothing and nothing doing. If you try, it's a very subtle, very deep point of Dharma, especially for this time of night. But doing nothing is always doing nothing. Nothing doing is nothing's happening. You're just quiet, silent. So don't do letting go. Let go of doing. Understand? Okay, I better go through these questions because I'm going slow. Here we go. Ajahn, can you explain briefly what stages in the Anapanasati correspond to Kaya Anupassana, Veda Anupassana, Dhamma Anupassana, and Chitta Anupassana? Okay, these are the four Satipatthanas, being aware of the body. The Buddha actually made this very clear in the suttas. Watching the breath is part of body contemplation. And remember what I said, the reason why we do body contemplation is actually not as an anatomy lesson, so you become a doctor afterwards. That's why some people, when they saw I've written a book, Open the Door of the Heart, so thought it was something about like surgery for sort of heart complaints. So, and even when we had the new title in the United States, who ordered this truckload of dung, they thought of putting it in the gardening section. But when you pull Kaya Anupassana, that's the meditation or reflection on the body. This is the breath. It's part of the body. And you do the body contemplation to let go of the body. You watch the breath as a stepping stone to let go of the body completely. That's why the purpose of the first Satipatthana is actually to detach from the body enough you can put it down, let it go, and access the mind. That's the first four stages of Anapanasati. When your breath disappears, then you've fulfilled the first stage of Satipatthana. You've seen the body enough, you can let it go. The only way you know that you're detached is when things disappear. The only way you know you're not attached to smoking is when you give up. Before, you know, you're still attached. You think, oh, I can give up any time, just, you know, not today. You're attached, you're just making a delusion. And Vedanupassana, this is when you start to get the joy and the bliss in the meditation. This is a beautiful breath stage, because the beauty, the feeling of happiness becomes more dominant. The breath is just either disappears or it's, you know, just secondary, and it's the joy and the happiness is the most important. And when you get into this beautiful breath stage, you're just watching, you're supposed to be watching, you know, you think you're watching the breath, but what you're really aware of is just so peaceful, so joyful, so nice. That is the Vedanupassana stage, as the Buddha taught it. Eventually the breath disappears, the weightiness sort of changes, and you see the beautiful nimitta. I'll mention this again later on, but that nimitta which comes up is a reflection of your citta, of the mind. As the Buddha said, this mind is radiant, is prabhasara, when the defilements are disappeared. Now you have right in front of you the radiant mind, the citta, which is like this beautiful radiant light. It's only at that point you can do cittanupassana. And this is why I make this point, and it's just so obvious if you've done meditation to just the level of nimittas, you don't know what the citta is. You don't know what you're reflecting upon unless you've got the deep meditations. You haven't got an idea what the mind is. You may think you know, but what are you really watching? It's only when you get to the stage of nimitta you can have some idea of what the mind truly is. But it's really when you get into the jhanas, then you really see the citta, the mind. This is why the Buddha called that nimitta like the moon released from the clouds. The moon is the citta, released from the five senses, the body. It's only then you understand what this mind truly is. So when you actually do this meditation, it's not just samatha, just for calming the mind. You're calming the body to realize what this mind is. And there in these deep meditations, it's right in front of you for hours and you can't miss it. And that's where you get your insight. That's vipassana, seeing clearly what the mind truly is. So it's only in those stages. And this is exactly what the Buddha said in the Anapanasati Sutta. In those, what is it, the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th stage. That's when you do cittanupassana. You get the nimitta. You brighten it up, you stabilize it, and then you release it to get into the jhanas. Read the jhanas of the 12th stage. And the Dhammanupassana, which is a meditation on Dhamma, or the Dhamma is a very beautiful word. Bhikkhu Bodhi just gave me the insight from one thing he just said, just in passing in a book. He said the Dhamma is like the source of things. It's where things come from. It's the origin of things. That's why he called it like a law, a basic truth. You go inside and see where things are coming from. And when you understand that as real Dhamma, it's not just where they lead to, and all these thoughts and all these words and descriptions and theories and philosophies, it's where the whole thing originates from. And that's the Dhamma which you see, but only when you've gone to the source in the deep jhana. And that's when you do at the end. The 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th stages of Anapanasati. You see, what is it, anicca? Anicca is not rise and fall, anicca is things disappearing. Things which were always there and now are no longer there. Things we never thought could disappear because they'd always been there. The background now vanishing for the first time. The inconstancy. That's what you see only after the jhanas. To see fading away. Much of life has faded away. Your body has faded away. The five senses have faded away. Much of your mind has faded away. Will has faded away. You see nirodha, the cessation. It's not just faded, it's ended for hours. There's not even a possibility of forming a will. the body is just beyond your consciousness. You can't feel anything. All the five senses have ceased for hours. You can't feel, you can't smell, you can't even hear any sound whatsoever. It's ceased. And the last one is Patinisaka. Thrown away. You've renounced, you've detached. You know what that truly is. It's not throwing away what's out there. It's throwing away what's in here. You've discarded your will. You've discarded your body. You've chucked it away for many hours. You've had experience of those things. And when you have experience, you know what they're talking about. So that's, in brief, how Anapanasati corresponds to the four Satipatthanas. Yes. That's Mickey Mouse Satipatthana. In other words, it doesn't go deep enough. You might read in the Satipatthana Sutta, at the end the Buddha says, if anyone does the Satipatthana for just 7 days, you'll either be a non-returner or fully enlightened. The Buddha does not make promises unless he knows that they're actually true. So, many people have done vipassana for more than 7 days, and there's none I've seen doing that who are non-returners or fully enlightened. They must be doing something wrong. It's not the Buddha hasn't made a mistake when he made that promise. It means a person hasn't been doing the Satipatthana properly. The most important part of the Satipatthana Sutta is the prerequisite of Vinaya Loke Abhijja Domanasa. Vinaya is like the gerund or absolutive. It means having put down, abandoned, got rid of. Every Satipatthana has that prerequisite. Loke Abhijja Domanasa. Professor Rice Davids, and he was an amazing translator. He got many things really, really right, but he stuffed up on that one. He made a big mistake. He didn't know what it meant. He just wrote, having abandoned grief and covetousness for the world. And I don't know why these old translations stick when it's very obvious. Anyone who reads Pali, who knows the suttas and knows the commentary, they're all in agreement here. That means having got rid of the five hindrances. Vinaya Loke Abhijja Domanasa. When I started reading the suttas in Pali for myself, I kept on coming across Loke Abhijja, Loke Abhijja, Loke Abhijja, instead of the first hindrance, Kamachanda. It's what we call a synonym. It's the same word. Sometimes the Buddha used, he had the description of the five hindrances, sometimes he used Kamachanda. Other times, about 40% of the time, he used Loke Abhijja. And I thought, I've seen this before, that's what that means in Satipatthana, having abandoned the first hindrance. And I saw the second one, Domanasang, what does that mean? Grief for the world, what are you talking about? And I saw in a couple of suttas there, the five hindrances, they had Kamachanda or Loke Abhijja, second hindrance, Domanasa. So these were synonyms. And the commentary said that, the commentary to both Satipatthana suttas in the Digha Nikaya and the Majjhima Nikaya, they said Loke Abhijja means Kamachanda, Domanasa means Vyapada, the ill will, the second hindrance. And they said in Pali, when you have a group which is repeated again and again, you put the first two of that group, it means the whole group. And this is actually, you see that again and again in the Pali. This is not just making it up. Instead of putting the whole group, you know, say, you know, the Labour Liberal Party and the Greens and the whatever else, they just do the two prominent ones and all the rest are implied. And so even the commentaries say Vinaya Loka Abhita Dhammanasang means having already abandoned the five hindrances. And that's the thing which people miss out. It's very clear in the Pali. You have to abandon the five hindrances first and then do Satipatthana if you want to become enlightened. No, it's just related to jhanas first. Jhanas is what abandons the five hindrances. Oh, it's okay, yes. It's a benefit, but it's a preparation. It's not enough. It's good, but it's not sufficient. Yes. Yes, the other foundations, Vinaya Loka Abhita Dhammanasang, runs through all the Satipatthanas and all the practices. It's what you're supposed to do first. And as it says very clearly again and again and again and again in the suttas, especially the clearest one is the Nalakapana Sutta, where the Buddha said, it's only through attaining a jhana that the five hindrances, together with weariness, what's the other one, and discontent. So only through attaining those jhanas, the five hindrances, weariness and discontent, do not invade the mind and remain. If you haven't got the jhanas, they invade the mind and remain, said the Buddha, Nalakapana Sutta. He made it very clear, the whole job of the jhanas is to abandon the five hindrances. And number two, to give you the data, to really see what the citta is. But without those things, you don't get anywhere. You're just scratching the surface. You start, yeah. But the whole point of the body contemplation at the beginning, to see the different postures, is to give you a bit of present moment awareness, a bit of silence, and then you go deeper to see this body is nothing to do with you. You can let it go, drop it. And you can drop the body, it disappears. You can't hear a sound, you can't feel any sensations in the body, no sight, smell, taste. It's all disappeared, together with the echoes called karma vitaka, the thoughts about the five senses. When they've all disappeared, then you know that you've let go of the body. And that's jhana. That's what happens. That's why, what is the last factor of the Eightfold Path? Jhana. Samasamadhi is always explained as jhana. Why is it in the, was it the Maha Gopalaka Sutta? No, that's the Moggala. Was it Moggala Ganaka Sutta or Ganaka Moggala Sutta, whatever it's called? The Buddha, actually, it wasn't the Buddha, but they asked someone just after the Buddha passed away, they asked Ananda, sort of, what type of meditation did the Buddha recommend? And Ananda said, straight away, the Buddha only recommended four types of meditation. That's the only one he praised. You know what those four types of meditation he praised were? First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That's the only thing which the Buddha recommended and praised. So I've got to follow the great teacher, that's the only thing which I recommend. Stop messing around, get to jhanas, and you'll understand why. Da-da-da. Next question. Do you know of the relationship of the pineal gland and meditation? No connection at all. The pineal gland is just a little gland in the front of the brain there somewhere. Because the brain has got nothing to do with meditation. That's why that sometimes it gets in the way. When you get into deep meditation, the brain stops. And, you know, all these stories about people who've got into the hospitals and they've put all the ECGs on their brain in deep meditation and it's absolutely level. The brain is not working. So those monks who've, you know, been on those machines and they said this area lights up because they're very, very happy, that's only superficial meditation. In the very deep meditation, nothing lights up at all. The whole thing is stopped, dead, and you're like a corpse. And they look at you, there's no breath going on at all, and the brain is not active. so absolutely still. There's another guy used to come here. I haven't seen him for a while now, but he came up to tell me. This was a long time ago, before we built the new hall at Nolamara. Because he had this very, very bad back problem. And, Brian. You know, Brian, who always comes on a Friday night, he knows him really well. I think his name was Jeff or something. Forget now, anyway. An English guy. He had this very bad back problem because he was in constant agony with this back problem. You know, he learned some meditation and he had to let go because otherwise it was just too painful. And so he got into these very deep meditations, and he came up to me once after the meditation session and he said, "I've finally done it." So what have you done? Because I like it when people say that. What have you been up to? And he said, "I managed to get the EEG flat." And I said, "I thought it meant ECG, you know, stop your heartbeat, because that's not so hard to do. Especially to make your mind so still that the heart stops." He said, "No, that was easy. I did that months ago. Now I've got the EEG flat." And you've gone into such a deep meditation that when they pull this EEG, you know, they measure your brain activity, is completely flat, no activity discernible at all. And then he smiled and he said, "See all those people in the back there? They're all my doctors and nurses from Osborne Park Hospital. And they just want to find what the hell's going on in this place." That's really nice, a nice experience, that. And that's what actually happens. So, you know, you can actually get your brain inactive and your mind is perfectly alert. So that's just proof that your pineal gland has nothing to do, you know, with your mind. So in meditation, you can completely transcend all your pineal glands. Bhante. Oh, Mrs. Samatha, Mrs. Vipassana. If Mr. Samatha and Mrs. Vipassana saw the same sight view at the top of the mountain, why didn't Mr. Hindu Samatha see the same sight view when he got to the top of the mountain? E.g. dudes like Alara Kalama and Anutika Ramaputta. Dudes. That's a young person who must have written that. So anyway, the point was, Alara Kalama and Anutika Ramaputta, as I wrote in the book which is coming out in August, that there's no way they could have attained those jhanas. First of all, they weren't Hindus. There was no Hinduism at that particular time. The Vedic form of the religion, which later sort of morphed into Hinduism, was just of propitiatory rites to devas up in heaven, sacrifices. There was no recorded meditation as such done before the time of the Buddha. This is an important thing to understand. The Hindus actually put their religion way back, but they got no real authority to do so. Because if you look at the text and you use like Western criticism, which does not bend the faith to fit the facts, bends the faith to fit the facts. Get the evidence very clear. And Alara Kalama and Anutika Ramaputta, whatever they taught, the Buddha said it was not conducive to enlightenment. Later on, after the Buddha's enlightenment, he said the jhanas are conducive to enlightenment many, many times. So whatever those people taught, it could not have been the jhanas. When the Buddha, before he sat under the Bodhi tree, when he recalled a jhana, he recalled the jhana when he was a kid. He never recalled the jhanas which were far more recent under Alara Kalama and Anutika Ramaputta, these two early teachers. Point was, there's no way they could have been jhanas, otherwise that's what he would have recalled. The solution to that problem, and which is getting more and more acceptance these days, is that whatever Alara Kalama and Anutika Ramaputta taught, they may have given it the name of the Akincha Nyayatana Samadhi, the meditation on nothingness, and the Nevasanya Nasanya Ayatana, another perception or non-perception. They had the names, but what they taught was not the real thing. In the same way, these jhanas are becoming more popular in the world amongst the meditation teachers. For example, last November, when I was in the United States, I was actually quite surprised to get an invite to have tea with Joseph Goldstein and then with Jack Kornfield afterwards. And I wonder what they were doing, because this was like the heart of, like, you know, Vipassana in the United States. And when I actually got in there, I realized why, because they were pumping me with questions on jhanas, asking what they were and why they were and how you do these things. And when I started talking to them, they started talking about some of their experiences. They were trying for jhanas, and it wasn't the right time to tell them what they were doing was nothing like jhanas. What they're actually saying, they called it jhana light, L-I-T-E. You know, it's like in the United States, you know, this light and that light. But what they were doing, their teacher Upandita was actually telling them, sort of, when you get to a deep state of, you know, reasonable stillness, you know, you don't go to any nimittas, just to make the determination like vitakka and see what happens. And they got something come up, and oh, that must be vitakka. Now make the determination vichara. Now make the determination pity. Now make the determination sukha. Now make the determination ekagata. The five so-called jhana factors. And now make the determination, may they all come in one together. And I didn't have the heart to tell them. It wasn't the right time to tell them. That's not jhanas. But they want jhanas so much that, you know, they give them that name. And that's just one example. And I've seen many other examples of people, because jhanas become popular now, because the message is out there, people can read it for themselves. It's obvious if you look at the suttas yourself that jhanas is necessary for enlightenment. So now everyone wants to get the jhanas. So what they're doing is actually they're making these jhanas, they're less than the real thing. And this the same would have happened in the time of the Buddha. Whatever Alaraka Lama and Uddhaka Ramaputta taught, it wasn't the real thing. It's the same name, but not the real thing. That's the solution. It makes a lot of sense. But that's why the Buddha said what they taught did not lead to enlightenment. But the real things, like the meditation on nothingness, the attainment of nothingness, which is the arupa state, he said afterwards specifically that is conducive to enlightenment. You have a question? No, it's that idea of like people just becoming enlightened, fully enlightened, that is, by the words of the Buddha. That's actually, it's stated many, many times, that's actually impossible. And either the Buddha is inconsistent or we're not seeing the full picture. And if we're not seeing the full picture, because I gave a simile many years ago, it's like someone actually turning up, say, at our local university, University of Western Australia, at Convocation Day. And they see all these people dressed like penguins with these funny hats on being called up. And when you go up there, you know, you get your degree. And they get your photograph. And if you go to people's houses, that's all they see, the photographs of the convocation when you're handed a degree by some important person. You never see the photographs of them doing their examinations or their assignments or attending lectures. We only actually usually photograph, take the picture of the final moment. And that was the same, sort of, in many of the suttas. It was understood, assumed, that you have to be meditating deeply to get enlightened. But assuming that, what was the final thing, the final event, when you actually got, you know, the full enlightenment? And that's what is always hits the photograph. When you see a person who's won a gold medal in the Olympics, you never see them winning the heats. You only see them at the final, just when they get to the finishing tape. And that's actually what we have in the suttas. We have the photographs of the people just at the finishing tape of enlightenment, and all of their training, all of the other stuff they did, we don't photograph that. It's not recorded. but that's obvious, has to be there. Otherwise there's no consistency there at all. And of course someone looks at that photograph and because of wishful thinking they want the easy way to enlighten. They don't want to do this jhana business, it's just too hard, you have to give up so much, and you want an easy way. Please, can we have an easy way, please? I've been through these retreats and I'm not getting close to jhana. Is there another way, please? And of course, if you do offer another way, you get very popular. However, I have to be sincere and authentic. And there is no other way. If there was, the Buddha would have taught a sevenfold path, not an eightfold path. Now sometimes people think, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if you didn't have to keep precepts? No, but you have to keep precepts, otherwise there would only be a fivefold path. There would be no need to have sama wacha, sama kamanto, sama ajiwa, the right speech, action, and livelihood. That's important to have those things. So each one is very, very important, otherwise the Buddha would not have taught it. And samadhi is jhana. You can't argue anything less. One of the great things of Buddhism coming to the West is that we don't follow traditions blindly. I don't care if it's Ajahn Chah who says something, if it's wrong I'll argue with my teacher and he would praise me for that. And you look in those suttas there and it's very clear, and you practice what they say, and that what they say becomes your own experience. You do need the jhanas. It's obvious. If you get a jhana, you understand why. One of the things I said, the only people who say that jhanas are not necessary are the people who have never experienced jhanas. Anyone I know who has experienced those jhanas understands why it is necessary. And I'll talk about that maybe a lot later when I talk about deep insight in jhanas or why they're necessary. Yeah, go on. I know that sometimes it really depends on what tradition of Zen, because remember Zen comes from the Chinese Chan, which actually comes from jhana, so it came from the jhana tradition, and many of the original monks would have actually sat very, 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 very still. And those really weird teachings, you know, that once you're actually coming from a place of jhana, then you can maybe understand what they're trying to say. But if you don't understand that stillness and emptiness of the mind, it just becomes like an intellectual game. And this is one of the problems for people. And it becomes far, far, far too superficial. When they say there's nothing to gain, nothing to achieve, you can understand what I've been saying here about letting go. But they're not really understanding that. They're actually not doing anything at all, not even sitting. They're just allowing just the old defilements to actually just to live as they always have been living. I'm thinking that's enlightenment. When they say, like the third Zen patriarch's teaching, that the path is easy for those without any preferences. That's brilliant teaching if you understand what no preferences is. No preferences means no desire, and if you do that properly, it always ends up in jhanas, in stillness. But if you don't do that properly, it just ends up you indulging whatever you want to do. And so once you get the deeper teachings, you understand where those great words of advice come from, but you can't understand them unless you've had the experience. That's why sometimes people get a guidebook to Paris and they go instead to Blackpool and they say there's a tower there. Oh, that must be Paris, because it says they've got this big metal tower there. Now Blackpool in England has got this metal tower, and it's not. The point is that you've got to go to these places before you really understand what the descriptions are. So Zen is fine when it's original form. And sometimes actually you do see people like the monastics, not sort of the American Zen so much as, you know, some of the, like the Chinese Zen tradition, and they really meditate deeply. And it doesn't really matter what tradition you call yourself, if you let go properly, the mind empties, becomes so still, and that becomes a jhana. You sit there blissed out for hours, and then you look at that state afterwards, and the Dhamma is so prominent that usually it's very clear what happens next. We're going to the deep stuff this evening, so no jokes. But I've got two more to go. A monk once said at Dhamma Loka Center, I hope this wasn't me, it's a waste of time teaching meditation and having meditation retreats for lay people because they return to their homes only to indulge in sensual pleasures. The Buddha never held meditation retreats for lay people. Your view, please. I hope that wasn't me. It's amazing you say so many things. That's not true. Because even in the time of the Buddha, many lay people became enlightened and they did meditate. And there's one of these guys that I really, one of my little heroes, Chitta the householder. He called Chitta the householder. He was a non-returner. And he had all the jhanas because, you know, in the Sanyutta Nikaya, you know that new edition of the translation of the Sanyutta Nikaya? Was it Collected Discourses of the Buddha? When I got my copy, first of all, I opened it up, and the first page I opened to was this great, one of my favourite suttas in that whole collection, Chitta the householder, and he has this conversation with the leader of the Jains, Mahavira. Otherwise, now what was his other name? Nataputta. Because they lived in the same area at the same time. And this Chitta goes up to see Mahavira, and Mahavira says, you know, do you believe all this nonsense that you can actually stop thinking? Even like stop the mind moving, you can actually have stillness. And Chitta says, I don't believe that at all. And even though the Buddha says it, I don't believe it. And then Mahavira, the leader, says, see, even this prominent sort of teacher, prominent disciple of the Lord Buddha, he doesn't believe this because it's impossible. You can't stop the thinking. It's like trying to stop the river Ganges with a fist. It's impossible that you can become still. And then Chitta says, I don't believe it because I know it, because I experience those jhanas. And Mahavira say, these disciples of the Buddha, they're tricky, they're sneaky, you can't have a proper conversation with them. But the point was, and I mentioned this in the book, it was very clear that the leader, probably he was even more famous than the Buddha by the sounds of it, he didn't know anything about jhanas. And so if the leader of the Jains, one of the great spiritual leaders of that time, had no conception that jhanas were possible or what they were, it shows that they weren't well known at that time. They weren't well known at all. That's why, you know, I'm putting my head on a chopping block, but I maintain this, and it's very, very clear. It says so in the suttas, the Buddha discovered jhanas. It actually says that in two suttas. Interesting. Anyhow, so lay people got jhanas in those days, and that's why I teach retreats. I don't know even if Ajahn Chah said that, and I say, sorry Ajahn Chah, you're wrong. Lay people do get deep meditation, and it is good for them. So why not? That's why I teach retreats. They're very popular. So whoever said that, I think it was probably because they hadn't enough experience of lay people who are committed and who do meditate well and do get deep meditations. So I don't know who that was, but they're wrong. Is that okay? Any questions about that? I don't think you'd argue with me there. Now, the next one. The more retreats I come to and the more I stay at the monastery, it seems the more inspired I am in leaving the world one day. There you go, that shows. It's very good. Isn't it great having that right afterwards? And it's a different handwriting. I didn't write this. And it's true. Because, you know, when it's one of the problems then. You know, you warn people on retreats. If you get into a jhana, something happens. You can't see the world in the same way, even if you just get into a little bit of deep meditation. There's this something which is so beautiful there, and so meaningful, so real. Look at all the other experiences of your life. Nothing really matches. Nothing is as good as the peace of the mind and the bliss. It's just sheer pleasure, and its depth, its profundity, its peace. And that's my life anyway. Whenever I had my first deep meditation as a lay person, and look what happened to me. I had a girlfriend then, and just, but afterwards, you know, you think, what am I doing this for? And there's a pleasure which is far deeper, more profound. And notice you can't forget those experiences, and after a while, you just got to follow them. The most wonderful, deep, religious, meaningful, purposeful experience of your life. So peaceful, so still, so lovely, so free. It seems so true. You realize that's the meaning of life you just touched. Well, the Buddha called it a taste of freedom. And once you've tasted that freedom, you can't stay too much longer in jail. You've been in a prison, born in a prison, lived all your life in a prison, and now you're seeing through the window for the first time of what it's like outside. You can't forget that experience. You have to go out. No more do you think that prison is the only thing of life. You realize what a prison is now. So it's important. I don't do this to wreck your relationships. I don't do this to sort of spoil your enjoyment of your lay life. Just truth, and I'd be lying to you, I'd be insincere, I'd be deceiving you, and I won't do that to tell you otherwise. But be careful, if you follow this path, you will usually end up, if not as a monk or a nun, but living like a monk or a nun. As some of you already do. You live like nice peaceful lifestyles, maybe not actually joining a monastery, but you know, you just have few possessions, hang around a Buddhist center. You go on retreats, you know, live close to monasteries, meditating, just like Chitta the householder, getting into jhanas, having a wonderful time, just being free of all possessions, even as a lay person. So that's where it will lead. So if hopefully your husbands, your wives don't hear this, otherwise they're saying, "Ah, no, you can't go to those retreats with Ajahn Brahm. I'm going to lose. There's my wife, there's my husband." It's worthwhile because you get happy and you're getting out of samsara. It's worthwhile doing. Okay, those are some very deep questions tonight. And some, hopefully, some powerful answers. So I've gone over time tonight. But you did not seem to be nodding or sleepy. So it's amazing when you get interesting questions. You get energized and you don't get bored. So it's 9:30 now. Isn't it amazing? If we'd have stopped at 8 o'clock, at 9 o'clock, you'd have all gone to bed by now, most of you. But when it's interesting, then you don't get tired. So there we are. This is the jhanas, what they're all about, and how they're conducive to enlightenment, how they will change your life as they change many monks' lives. If you really want some real truth in life, not just theory, but experiences, you've come to the right place. This is going to change your life forever. All those lifetimes of wandering around in samsara. And the Buddha said, you cried more tears throughout this whole journey of many lives than there are waters in the whole oceans. That's why the oceans are salty, because of all your tears. Didn't know that, did you? I just made that up too. But now is a chance to get out. You lucky people, the doors are open to the deathless. And there they are, right in front. Just go through. Or are you going to go to bed instead? I know what you're going to do. So good night, have a nice sleep. See you in the morning.